from Turtle Island to Palestine. Occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine. You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
This is the Mondo Weiss Podcast. I'm Dave Reed. In this episode, Mondo Weiss's Yumna Patel speaks with Palestinian lawyer and political analyst Diana Boutu about the genocide in Gaza and the role social media is playing in how it unfolds. Israeli soldiers on the ground in Gaza are undermining Israel's carefully crafted public image as a victim through their social media posts, which show them joking, laughing, and committing what many legal observers believe are war crimes. This second Nakba is being live-streamed in real time, and Yumna and Diana discuss the experience Palestinians are sharing of watching a genocide of their people play out on their mobile phones.
There's so much to talk about. There's so much that has happened and that is happening over the past 3 months now, which just feels crazy to say. And to me, as I've been witnessing this genocide that's happening and also trying to process it and also trying to report on it and share it with the world. To me, there's been, in addition to all the Israeli atrocities, I've also seen this genocide really being defined by the media and by social media in particular, and also, of course, the U.S. government, who is actively funding this. So that's kind of what I wanted to talk about today, is sort of the roles of the mainstream media, of course, of social media, the U.S. government, and how in a lot of cases, and still to this day, the people of the world, we are witnessing a genocide unfold, but we are essentially at the same time being gaslit by all sort of mainstream avenues, by our politicians in the U.S., I would also say by the international community, and of course, by Israeli politicians as well. So to start off, I wanted to ask you what your experience has been in that regard. You know, you're in Palestine. You are in 48, so you are experiencing this occupation and apartheid in a way that's very different to Gaza, but it still is this collective experience that Palestinians have been going through. So, and I know this is a big question, what has this been like for you to be witnessing this genocide happening, obviously witnessing the changes happening around you where you live in real time, but also witnessing these atrocities from your telephone or from your television screen?
Oh, Yumna, where do I begin? One of the most difficult things is being 150 kilometers away from Gaza, and knowing what Israel's doing 150 kilometers away, and yet living in a society that is openly cheering this on and then suppressing any attempts to bring forward any voices or any criticism of what Israel is doing. Mm-hmm. I've had the privilege of living in Gaza. I lived there for a year and a half in the mid-2000s. And so I have many, many, many friends there. And I'm not the only one who has friends there. Every Palestinian I know has either friends or family living in Gaza. And even if they don't, our hearts are there. And so when you're living in 48, as I'm living, you live in a space where you're surrounded by people who are cheering on the genocide, who are openly advocating for genocide, and at the same time, repressing any attempts to talk about what Israel's doing. So, for example, Israel has barred any and all protests against this war, with the exception of protests that are carried out in Tel Aviv by the Jewish Israeli community. Mm-hmm. Palestinians in 48 have been arrested for things like Facebook posts or even liking a picture on Instagram. We've seen that hundreds of students have been disciplined, not for anything that they did on campus, but again, for social media posts, for even liking a social media post, with these universities even going so far as to then send these complaints to the police themselves. And one of the things that's the most disturbing about this is that this isn't just the state apparatus that's going after Palestinians. It's your neighbor. It's your colleague. Yeah. It's the person you're at study group with. And you just see that this whole machinery of supporting genocide is against you. For example, in Haifa, where I live, there are now militias that you see openly roaming the streets, carrying weapons, and they go through your social media posts and people place you on a list. I know that I personally have been placed on a list. I know that I personally have been subjected to complaints to the Israeli police for interviews that I have given. And I'm not alone. We've seen the arrest of people like Dalal Abu Amni for a Facebook post that says, "There is no protector but God," or the arrest of Maysa Abdelhadi for liking an Instagram post, which she then later removed. So to live here is to live in a society that is openly supporting, in some cases, advocating genocide and feeling that you are next. But it doesn't just stop there. You then look down at your phone and you see the level of dehumanization that Palestinians go through on a daily basis. Again, not just from the Israelis, but globally. Everything from the way that this genocide is being covered, everything from whether they label it a genocide, whether they listen to what Israeli leaders are saying when they openly advocate ethnic cleansing and genocide, whether they are wholeheartedly going along with the bombing of hospitals and schools and the measures that Israel's taking to bomb not only the north, but the south, and somehow framing this as phases to a war. So being a Palestinian here is to be living in the belly of the beast, to be surrounded by people who are supporting and advocating genocide, and yet knowing that 150 kilometers away, Israel's carrying out a genocide, and we just might be next.
Yeah. I think you hit on this experience that I have witnessed from my Palestinian friends, and something that everyone has been experiencing, of living in, as you described it, the belly of the beast, whether it be in 48 or in Ramallah or Bethlehem in the West Bank, or of course in Jerusalem or Gaza. Everyone is experiencing different degrees and levels, right, of Israel's occupation and apartheid and Israeli violence from the settlers, as you mentioned, from your neighbors, if you're living in 48, or from the soldiers and the state itself. And as you're experiencing that, you mentioned you're also looking at your phone screen and seeing the entire world, or the political establishment in the US, for example, which is funding this genocide. You're seeing the active denial of your experience that you are currently going through. I mean, for me, as I would describe someone from the outside looking in, someone who cares about Palestine, and frustrating doesn't even begin to describe that feeling of like witnessing, experiencing, being a part of this reality, and then having people deny it. So I can't imagine what that experience was like for you and for other Palestinians.
To live in Palestine, or to be Palestinian, is to live with this constant sense of Nakba denial or Nakba apology, mm-hmm. right? And especially when you live here in 48, Israelis are either Nakba deniers or they're Nakba apologists. There's very few who condemn the Nakba and who are actively trying to advocate for the right of return. The numbers are few. And so you have to fast forward that 75 years. And what we're living today is the Nakba 2.0, which is exactly what Israeli politicians are calling it, is Nakba 2.0. So it's the same. It's either genocide apologists or genocide deniers, or even worse, the open supporters of it. And there's few here who are stepping back and saying, this is genocide, we have to stop. So it's the feeling of constantly being gaslit. I can give you an example. At one point in time, the Israelis came out and said something like, we can't be certain of the number of people who've been killed in Gaza, because these are numbers that are being counted by the people in Gaza. Well, you only believe that if you are actively dehumanizing people. Of course, the numbers are going to be counted by the people in Gaza.
Who else would they be counted by? Yeah,
exactly. Who else are they going to be counted by? But then the amazing thing is that from that one statement, instead of the U.S. reaction, for example, being the reaction that you and I just had, which is, of course, they're going to be counted by the people in Gaza. Where else are they going to be counted? Or by whom else are they going to be counted? The response was, yeah, we can't believe those numbers. So then Palestinians then have to further dehumanize themselves by issuing a 212-page document with the names, the ages, and the ID numbers of all of the, at that point in time, 7,067 Palestinians that had been killed up until that date. And even despite issuing this document with all 7,067 names, 212 pages up until that point, you still had people who were also questioning and still question the numbers. Mm-hmm. And so it leads you to believe, well, what did you think was going to happen when on a weekly basis, Israel's dropping 6,000 bombs on a place that is 365 square kilometers? Of course, there's going to be close to 30,000 people killed. Of course, there's going to be in the thousands of people who are still trapped in rubble. Of course, there's going to be in the tens, if not higher, thousands of people who've been injured. Of course it is. But we're still trapped in this cycle where, because Palestinians have been so dehumanized, that you're still even having to prove that you've been killed. You have to prove that the people who've been injured have been injured. You have to prove that Israel has flattened Gaza, even though they've said that they're flattening Gaza. It's like you're always in a place where you have to prove everything that Israel has said that it's going to do and is doing.
Yeah. This experience that you're talking about of Palestinians having to, the way you put it, further dehumanize themselves by trying to just prove that we are in fact being killed, we are in fact being exterminated, I think is an experience truly, at least in this point of time, unique to Palestinians. And in my experience studying Palestine, living in Palestine, reporting about Palestine, and also, you know, being a journalist and having studied media, I always thought, and still to a degree, with the emergence of social media, really felt like, okay, social media in all of its levels, I had always felt that social media could and does offer a space for a different narrative, right? So with the existence of social media, Palestinians in this case do not have to rely anymore on mainstream media outlets and networks like CNN, for example, to be telling their own story or telling the world what is happening to Palestinians. So you think, right, okay, with social media, Palestinians are telling their own stories. That means people will believe them. And I want to talk about this more. I think social media really has changed things in the sense that a lot of people really are witnessing for the first time with their own eyes around the world what is happening to the Palestinians. But at the same time, we're seeing this extreme reaction to that. Everyone is witnessing what's happening, but there's this extra level of gaslighting with that, you know, of like, no, actually, this is not happening to Palestinians. Actually, you know, there's a genocide. Hamas is trying to commit a genocide against the Jewish people. And Jewish people around the world are experiencing a genocide. Or, you know, the real threat right now is on campuses, for example, right? And anti-Semitism on campuses. So there's this extreme gaslighting of Palestinians, and then also like deflection, right, to other issues, be it manufactured or exaggerated to essentially detract from Palestinian experiences. And that has been one of the most mind-boggling experiences, is to like see that play out and see politicians and congressional hearings and the media talking about the dangers of anti-Semitism on U.S. campuses and how chants are calling for the genocide of the Jewish people when in reality there is an active genocide happening.
Yes. There's a few things to say about social media. First, social media does remove that gatekeeping, right? It removes those barriers. You don't have that barrier to access that was once there. But social media is also a series of silos, and you follow those accounts that you want to follow, mm-hmm. and you don't follow those accounts that you don't want to follow. Right. So there's certainly a lot of activity on social media. And we do see that despite the billions, and it is in the billions, that Israel has invested in PR campaigns and trying to influence in social media, the numbers are definitely not in their favor because they have a bad product. So let's be clear. And of course, there's ways that they can put pressure to have people shadow banned and to change algorithms and to have it such that people's accounts get taken down. We've seen all of this. But at the same time, despite all of that, we've seen that there have been some real breakthroughs and that people are becoming much more aware of what's happening in Palestine. So these issues that are manufactured are precisely that, manufactured. And as much as they're manufactured, I think because people are seeing the images that we're seeing, and they're small, right? Because of all the shadow bans and all these other things, we're not seeing the full extent of it. And of course, because we don't live in Gaza, we are not seeing the full extent of it either. But despite all of that, we're seeing that people aren't believing the manufactured stuff. Mm-hmm. And so for me in particular, it feels so odd to be sitting in a place where massacre after massacre is being perpetrated every day. Genocide is being carried out every day. The Israelis have been clear about the ethnic cleansing process of Gaza. They've been clear. Every level of government has been clear. And yet you see that rather than Israelis focusing on what they are doing, they're instead focused on creating a totally different reality in a totally different country, mm-hmm. and perpetuating this narrative that is designed to deflect from what they're doing. And they are deflecting from what they're doing. They aren't paying attention. Being here is such an exercise in, I don't even know the word. It's like living in a parallel universe. You turn on the news and you hear about Israeli soldiers killed. It then pivots to a person who rallies up Israelis to say, we have to hit Palestinians more. There should be 100,000 killed. There shouldn't be a single Gazan left. I mean, this is on the news daily, by the way. To then pivoting to how persecuted Israel is. The whole time, what's missing in all of this is, what is it that Israel is actually doing in Gaza? And the whole point and the reason that they're not covering this is because they want to deflect. They don't want people to see. I'm not going to cut them slack and say they don't know. Of course they know what's happening. Mm-hmm. You have every ability to check any news outlet around the world and see the numbers of Palestinians who've been killed. You can't look at that and say, oh, but. But the way in which Israel is operating is to forever put itself in the role of the victim, even though it's the perpetrator of a genocide. Yeah. And that's the part that's so hard to wrap your head around.
The last point that you made is that Israel has always, you know, throughout history, positioned itself as this victim that is constantly under attack, right? And is constantly in need to defend itself from its hostile neighbors. And that's the narrative that's been pushed for decades, right? Around the world.
But the question is, why do they have hostile neighbors?
Right.
And that's the question that they never ask, is why is it that our neighbors are so, as they put it, hostile? They're quote unquote hostile for a reason, because you took somebody else's country and you kicked them out. Yeah. And so this is the part that Israel's always attempting to decontextualize what it has done. it attempts to turn Palestinians into somehow irrational actors. It completely tries to turn Palestinians into not only irrational actors, but this threat that they must eradicate, when the whole point is that Palestinians are actually very rational. Anybody who is facing the ethnic cleansing from their home is going to push back. Anybody whose house is being taken over is going to push back. Of course they are. Nobody wants to be removed from their home. Nobody wants to feel unsafe in their home and in their homeland. And that's the part that Israel isn't willing to understand. They want history to end somehow for Palestinians with the creation of the state of Israel. And then history ends. And then it begins again on October 7th. This is the way that Israel has always positioned itself. So there isn't anything that happened before 1948. And there's nothing that happened after from 1948 until the current day. That's the way that they want us to behave. And of course, people are seeing through it.
Yeah. You don't feel like anything good has happened. Nothing good has come out of any of this. Of course, this mass slaughter and genocide. But the one tiny positive thing that I feel like I have seen is exactly what you just said, is maybe somewhere people are seeing through it. The people that are witnessing it, the people whose screens this is coming across, the people who are paying attention. I mean, I'm constantly on social media, right? And I was on social media however many years ago when I was in college too, but I've noticed such a huge difference in the way that people, especially young people, how their opinions are being formed right now. And Israel and the US will say, oh, you know, young people are being brainwashed by TikTok and by social media, and, you know, they're being fed all these lies to hate Israel, whatever. But I actually think, exactly like you said, people are just seeing through that Israeli narrative. They're seeing right through the propaganda. They're seeing right through the US government propaganda and support for Israel. Because when a young person opens up their phone, right, and they follow whoever they follow from Gaza, they see bombs being rained down, people being displaced, children being killed, people starving and freezing to death in tents and refugee camps in Gaza. And then they see Israel and the U.S. saying, like, Israel is the victim. Israel needs to defend itself. Israel has a right to defend itself. But then they see whatever official Israeli propaganda is going out there, I think, in my opinion, is being actively undermined by what Israeli soldiers themselves are actually posting on social media, directly to TikTok, Instagram, Telegram, whatever it may be. Every single day, there is a new video of soldiers acting so callously in Gaza, blowing up homes, mocking Palestinians, burning down their homes, you know, doing marriage proposals, save the date announcements before they blow up a home. All of these things that are so callous and so inhumane and make such a mockery of human life, people are seeing that and saying, wait, I don't get how we're being told that this is the victim here. You know, something doesn't make sense. And so that's also been something really interesting to witness, is that Israel's propaganda machine, like you said, they just don't have good product. But also, I think they're actively being undermined by their own soldiers and those soldiers' social media activity that people are witnessing and being like, hey, this is really messed up.
It's a few things. You're absolutely right. So first, it's a very bad product. And no matter what you do, you can have as many influencers to try to claim that the product is good. We've all seen through this. It's a bad product. Yeah. But second, there's such a level of arrogance to these soldiers that they think that these videos are only being viewed by them. And they've dehumanized Palestinians so much that they don't even see Palestinians as humans. Like, they don't even see that what they're doing is wrong. And they arrogantly believe that what they're doing is actually kind of cute. Who blows up a Palestinian house for your child's second birthday? Who takes over a Palestinian house and writes a save the date as a wedding announcement? Unless you just fundamentally don't see Palestinians as humans. And people see through that. So they see through the bad product when they see how Israel's bombing kids, bombing hospitals, bombing schools, when you see people being pulled out of rubble, when you see the level of dignity that Palestinians have, and when you see the lack of dignity that Israelis have, and they've shown it time and again, day in and day out, they're so arrogant with their lack of dignity that soldiers actually think that what they're doing is cute. And people see past that. You remind me actually of something, you know, having lived here, it's a very racist society. And people are very open about their racism in ways that I've never experienced in other countries around the world that are racist. The United States is racist. But this is such an open level of racism and actually kind of a pride in racism. And when you live here for a while, the racism becomes so normalized that people who are from the outside and come in, after a while, they take on that same level of racism, and that the racist statements stop affecting them because it just becomes par for the course. So I've heard many, many, many diplomats, journalists, others say, oh, but isn't that the way Israeli society is? So rather than them questioning the racism, it's just kind of like, oh, they just normalize it and accept it. This is what these soldiers are doing now, is that it's such a high level of dehumanization that it's become normal in many ways to see these videos of people blowing up a Palestinian house to celebrate their child's second birthday, to take over a Palestinian house for a save the date, to rummage through Palestinian clothes and find lingerie, God forbid, to go through their kitchens and look at what it is that Palestinians use to cook. It's become so commonplace now that Israelis don't even see it any longer. That's how normal it's become. But yet, when you're on the outside, this is not normal, because it isn't normal. And that's the glimpse that the rest of the world is now seeing. They're actually seeing what we live every day.
So many of the stories, like especially the last one that you mentioned, and I think a lot of us have seen these videos of Israeli soldiers going in and rummaging through Palestinian homes. There was a video that went viral very recently of a group of soldiers. I don't know, I guess they're in the same troop or whatever it is. And they edited this whole video together where, you know, they were cooking in the house, they were using the kitchen, they were doing all this stuff. And then they left. And as they left, they burned the house down. And I truly couldn't believe what I was seeing, the levels of dehumanization, especially when you know that if that Palestinian family who lived in that home, if they're even still alive, that they're not that far away from where their home is, maybe just a few kilometers away, seeking refuge in maybe a school or in a camp or somewhere. And seeing videos like that immediately, in my mind, harken back to the stories that we've heard about the Nakba, right? And how the Israeli soldiers, you know, they kicked families out from their home, and the settlers or the soldiers, when they got to the home, there was still food on the table or the food was still warm. And I know all over Palestine, in the West Bank, you have Palestinian refugees who are kicked out of their homes in the Nakba, who are living literal kilometers away from where their village either still stands and is being occupied by settlers, where their village was destroyed to the ground. You mentioned the Nakba at the beginning, that it's so clear that this is another Nakba, but this time it's being like broadcasted to us. It's live, it's happening live. And that is so crazy. And what's even crazier than that is, I've heard this before, you know, my friends have said, you know, what if there were phones, or what if there was social media, like back when the Nakba happened? Maybe would that have changed things? Or would Israel and the world not be denying our history for 75 years if there was more documentation? But we're witnessing a Nakba now live, and that denial is still happening.
You remind me of a few things. My late father was from a small town just outside of Nazareth, called the Limjedir. And in 1948, his family, and not just his family, the entire town fled to neighboring Nazareth. Some fled even further to Lebanon, to Syria, to Jordan. My father ended up living in a house that is exactly 3 kilometers away from his original home. He was never allowed to go back to Limjadil, even until his death in 2021. He used to talk to me and describe that for him, it wasn't just a question of losing his house. And my grandmother used to say the same thing. It wasn't just a question of losing your house, but about losing your home. Because there's a difference between a house and a home, the security, the safety, but also having Israel rob them of community, of who they are, and forever living in a place that isn't yours, where you're yearning to go back. As I said, from my father, who fled when he was 9 years old and died at the age of 82. For all of those years, he was never able to go back to his home, to his land. And that's what it's like to live as a Palestinian. And this is what we're witnessing today. So the decisions that I used to hear my grandmother talk about when she was describing what happened to her during the Nakba and what the Israelis did and how they had to take the decision to flee, I understood it on a logical level before, but now in my core, I understand it. I feel it. Because I know how they were weighing things and what they were seeing happening around them and how for them it was a question of life or death. And in Gaza, it's the same thing. It's a question of life or death. I used to think the same thing. If only people saw, if only they had. But the problem is that this is the most documented place ever. There are more reports that come out about Israel's atrocities every year than on any country around the world. In some cases, tenfold of any place around the world, if not more. So it's not a question of not knowing. It's a question of not wanting to act. And that's why I think so much of what you were saying about the images that we're seeing in the social media and the fact that it's a bad product, we wouldn't be seeing people in the millions coming out week after week around the world demanding that Israel stop if they actually believed the bad product and the bad influencers. It's because they're seeing this. At the same time, every day, I see a new image and I say, this is it. This is going to be the image that's going to strike at the hearts of people. And then the next day, this is going to be the image. And here we are 90 days into Israel's attack on Gaza. And we've seen tens of thousands of images, each more gruesome than the next. And it hasn't moved the politicians, but it has moved people. It has moved people. And that's where I think the change is happening, is that the influence that people are having is actually influencing politicians in a way that I didn't expect would happen. So yes, we have not seen calls for a ceasefire by Biden. Let's be clear. But for the first time, we are hearing people talking about halting arms to Israel. For the first time, we are hearing people talking about Palestinian freedom, including on a political level. For the first time, we are hearing people talk about the illegality of occupation and the siege. And that is simply because all of these images have driven people, and people are coming out in the millions because this affects them too. This is an issue of global humanity and affects them too. We're paying a very heavy price. And I don't want to feel despair.
Yeah.
Because I feel that Palestinians have shown the world such dignity and Israel has not. And that has really moved people. And that moving of people I ultimately believe will change the reality for Palestinians on the ground. It really will. It really will.
And I think you just have to believe that, right? Because how else do you reconcile everything that's happening, these feelings of despair and hopelessness? And what you talked about is a feeling that I truly think everyone has had, is today will be the day, this image of babies left to decompose in their hospital beds. Every image is just, there's more horror every day. And so it's hard to feel any sort of hope, but seeing people come out in numbers that we've never witnessed before, seeing so many people newly brought to this issue, to this cause, sort of awakened by everything that's happening. And it does give you some hope or some faith that hopefully the end is near, that the bombing will stop, that there will be a ceasefire. But then even more than that, you know, it doesn't just end there. Even if the bombing ends, Palestinians are still living under occupation. They're still living under apartheid and under an even more volatile and aggressive state and settler population. So the violence is still very much there. But I think what we're seeing now really is, as a result of these protests and these, you know, changes in public opinion, it's very clear that Israel is feeling very threatened. The U.S. is feeling threatened in its support of Israel. And that's, in my opinion, and I'd be curious to hear what you think about this, is the responses that we've seen, like, for example, you know, South Africa filed that appeal with the ICJ, with the International Court of Justice, against Israel to stop the genocide. And we had U.S. officials saying, you know, that is completely baseless. It has no basis in fact. And we see that we're like, okay, something's not adding up. This is the sort of gaslighting that we've been talking about, right? But I think when people see that, they don't believe anymore when the U.S. says, no, 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 that's not true. Don't believe that. People are saying, no, we're really witnessing something happening. There's clearly a disconnect between what is actually happening and what you're trying to support. And I think that's representative of just like the desperation from Israel and its allies to keep it in power in the face of so much global support behind Palestine.
The amazing thing is that so much has become clear. Do you know how sometimes, I don't know if you've ever noticed when you're here, but the clearest days are sometimes the coldest days? Right, where there's not a single cloud in the sky and you can see everything super clearly. That's where we're at right now. Everything has become clear. It's become clear that this is an Israeli attack, genocide on Gaza, but not just an Israeli attack on Gaza, an Israeli-American attack on Gaza. It's become very clear just how the United States, as much as it may try to claim that it's an honest broker, it's become clear that it is doing Israel's bidding. We've seen it with the fact that they vetoed a number of UN Security Council resolutions and then abstained from the other one. And it's become clear when you look at the history of the US use of the veto that it's only ever been used in two instances. One is when it comes to Israel, first and foremost. The second is when it comes to Russia on a much smaller scale. So it's become clear that this is Israel and the U.S. in lockstep with one another. But it's also become clear that everything that the world did up until this point has been a complete and utter failure. That the world, leave aside the U.S., which we know is in lockstep with Israel. But everybody else has also failed Palestinians, country-wise. I'm not talking about people. And it's also become clear that there's a huge difference between the people of the world and the leadership of the world. All of this has become clear. And lastly, what's become clear is this idea that there's some notion of global human rights or international human rights or an international system. There is no system. It's might is right. And people have deluded themselves over these years into thinking that somehow there is going to be countries that will rush to the defense of others to prevent genocide. You know, there have been other examples of genocide, but this is a genocide like no other, because this is being perpetrated against a defenseless civilian refugee population, refugees who've been raided, refugees by Israel. And if anything, this is the time where you should be seeing the world community act and rush to come to the defense of this refugee, stateless, defenseless, by the way, child population. And instead they're not, you know, just except for South Africa.
Yeah. We've covered so much ground in this conversation. And I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us, to share your thoughts, to share your own personal stories. I mean, the story of your father and your family's Nakba story. I mean, I had goosebumps listening to that. I think as much as we witness all the atrocities and so many people's hearts have been moved and called to action by what they're seeing in Palestine, truly no one can ever fathom the experience, the multi-layered, multi-generational experience that Palestinians experience every single day and are experiencing now to a degree that no one, I think not even many Palestinians, could even fathom. So thank you for sharing that. Thank you for speaking with us.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. From coverage of the war by Palestinian journalists on the ground, we turn to coverage by the Israeli media. What do most Israelis see on TV? How has the Israeli media's coverage shaped opinions of war? This is a clip from I-24 News of Israeli military commander Lieutenant Colonel Dotan talking about an alleged Hamas tunnel in an exclusive video shown by the network last week.
The IDF has found tunnels and weapons inside a child's room inside the Gaza Strip. These visuals were obtained from the IDF. And I-24 News is now going to be allowed to play that. Let's take a look.
During our patrols in the area, we uncovered the entrance to a tunnel under this children's bedroom, actually under this desk, exactly where the children were supposed to study. We can see very clearly the tunnel which goes towards the tunnel gallery. We can also see here these RPG missiles, these munitions grouped in the same sector, including military tactical vests and grenades ready for use.
That was a clip from Israeli media outlet I-24 News. For more on Israeli media's coverage of the war, we go to Tel Aviv, where we're joined by Gideon Levy, an award-winning Israeli journalist and author, columnist for the newspaper Aretz, a member of its editorial board. His most recent piece headlined, "If it isn't a genocide in Gaza, then what is it?" Gideon, welcome back to Democracy Now! Talk about what Israelis see on television, where most get their news. We just did this whole piece on the killing of Gazan journalists, Palestinian journalists. We've never seen anything like this anywhere in modern history, where you have between 80 and over 100 Palestinian journalists killed in just a matter of weeks. What do Israelis understand is happening?
The main question, Amy, is what they don't see or what they are not being shown. Because as you know, and as your viewers definitely know, Israeli media is quite a free media, commercial owned, quite liberal, no pressure from the government or secret services or army or things like this. Anything it does voluntarily. And the Israeli media decided almost wall to wall, maybe except of my newspaper, Haaretz, all the rest, it's not only TV, also newspapers. They decided that they are part of the Israeli propaganda machinery. They stop being journalists. And this they do in two ways. The first one is the most serious one. They don't show Gaza. The Israeli average viewer doesn't see Gaza at all. He sees the soldiers. He sees the families of the hostages. He's being told day and night about the Israeli sacrifice. He's being told day and night how brave are the soldiers. You see it days a week, 24 hours a day, and only one thing you don't see, the suffer of Gaza. And the media decided not to show it, not because anyone pushed the media not to do it. They do it because they know very clear that this is what their viewers don't want to see, and they want to please them. And by this, they are betraying our first mission, to tell the full story. You know, there are Israelis who wouldn't care less to see all those terrible images and say, Hamas is to be blamed, the Arabs are to be blamed, they deserve it, they are barbarian, everything is fine. But they have to see what is being done on our behalf. So that's the first level. The second level, which is less important, but still must be mentioned, is that Israeli media speaks now only in one voice. There is no room for any critic about the war. There is no room for any question marks. I don't remember a war in which, after so many stages, still the entire media is just a pale echo of the propaganda machinery of the army.
Well, Gideon, your newspaper, Haaretz, is somewhat different from the rest of the press, but how widely read is it within Israel, and who reads Haaretz?
Haaretz is not a big newspaper in terms of quantity, but it is still quite an influential newspaper, both abroad, as you know, because it's being published both in English and in Hebrew. And also in Israel, still parts of the elite are reading it. I don't want to say that every Israeli reads Haaretz, but every Israeli knows about Haaretz. And through the social media, it has some kind of influence, but it is obviously very limited.
Can you talk about the levels in Gaza we're hearing about, of starvation, that every Palestinian is hungry right now? The babies being pulled from the rubble. I mean, we're thousands of miles away from you. Tel Aviv is very close to Gaza. What do they see when it comes to casualties?
Nothing. They hear the figures, but figures are only figures. It's only statistics. It doesn't make you feel, it doesn't make you understand the scale of the tragedy, the scale of the crimes, I must say. You know, you watch all the international networks and you see Gaza. You see the children dying on the dirty floors of the hospitals, bleeding to death. You see the uprooted people. You see the destruction. You see the suffer of hundreds of thousands of people, and obviously the starvation. And in Israel, you see only the soldiers, only the families of the hostages, only the scenes where you don't see Palestinians at all. It seems as if they don't exist. Now, Amy, that's not new, because the Israeli media betrayed its mission by covering in the same way the occupations throughout so many years. It was always dehumanizing the Palestinians as much as possible. But this time we reach a level that I don't remember such a level, because you can really watch for hours Israeli TV and have no clue what's going on in Shifa Hospital or in other hospitals or in uprooted neighborhoods. And where are the people? How do they make their living? Do they get some food? Nothing of this. Nothing which might remind us that the Palestinians are human beings. This is almost a taboo. Don't mention them as human beings.
Gideon, Prime Minister Netanyahu keeps assuring the international community that Israel does not intend to permanently occupy Gaza. But what is he saying domestically to the Israeli people? He even has two Twitter handles, one that's an official one, and then another that is more geared toward sending out incendiary messages to the population.
Just this morning, he was quoted in a private talk, I think, that the war will continue at least until 2025. And nobody sees the end. Nobody knows the end. There is no end game. There is no plan what to do the day after. And Israelis start to believe now that this might last for many years, at least the occupation of Gaza. obviously without intention. Almost everything that Israel did in the last decades was without intention, but it always came out. It never intended to go for wars, and it always finds itself in war. It never intended to create an occupation of over 50 years, and it came out like this. No. The intention is one thing and the results are another thing. Israel has no plan to leave Gaza in the coming months or years, which doesn't mean that Israel will stay there. But I don't see any alternative right now. Where what will they do?
I wanted to ask you about your paper, Haaretz, reporting that a group of family members of Israelis who were killed in Kibbutz Be'eri on October 7th, in the Hamas attack on Israel, are demanding a probe into how their relatives died. An Israeli brigadier general recently admitted he ordered an Israeli tank commander to fire on a home where Hamas fighters were holding 15 Israeli hostages. Brigadier General Barak Haram told the New York Times he'd ordered the tank commander to, quote, break in even at the cost of civilian casualties. 13 of the Israeli hostages died. Only two survived. Gideon, you're a member of the Haaretz editorial board, which recently ran a piece headlined, "The IDF must investigate the Kibbutz Be'eri tank fire incident right now." Elaborate on what happened and the investigation your editorial board is calling for now.
Look, everyone is postponing all the investigation to the day after, and the day after seems to get farther and farther. And we are very concerned that it will never be investigated. But here we have a very concrete case, and families, rightly so, want to know who is responsible for the killing of their beloved ones and how did it happen. The brigadier general that you just mentioned happened to be a settler. I don't want to say that it says a lot, but let's remember that many of our high-ranked generals, or more and more of them, are settlers, and settlers have their own ideology, even when they serve in the army. They have their own motivation, which is not always a very secular motivation. It's not always the motivation of the others. But in any case, the fact is that those people were killed and might have been rescued. It must be investigated. It's not very complicated to investigate it. It's a very concrete and focused event, and we were calling the army to do so. I don't know. Until now, we didn't hear from the army. I hope they will do it, because this can have also a lot of consequences in the coming days or weeks or months in Gaza, because this situation might repeat itself when we will face a house where there are hostages and commanders of Hamas. Do we shoot them all dead? I really wonder.
And you also had a piece on how sexism ultimately killed what are known as the spotters, the Israeli military, the women who were on the border, who were seeing Hamas gear up, were telling their supervisors, it looks like there's about to be an imminent attack. And some were even told if they raise this again, they would be brought up on charge of insubordination. Is that right, Gideon?
Yeah. We had a big story on this, but you know, the small stories might overwhelm or overshadow the big story. Because the big story, finally, there are two big, huge question marks. A, what happened on the 7th, and how did it happen? Because all those stories get to one conclusion, that there was no army on this day. There was not the most sophisticated intelligence in the world, with all the most sophisticated devices, who knows the color of the underwears of each Palestinian, all of a sudden didn't know anything. After all the money in which was invested there and all the reputation they have. And then came the second question, where was the army after the attack started? No army whatsoever. And above all, the question which bothers me more than anything else, and that's namely, having said what happened on the 7th, as barbaric as it was, whatever it was, there are question marks about certain events on the 7th, but it's very clear that there was an attack, a very aggressive attack. Does this give us Israelis the right to do anything we want after the 7th, forever, without any limits, no legal limits, no moral limits? We can just go and kill and destroy and destruct as much as we wish? That's the main question right now. The event that you mentioned with those soldiers' girls just show how unprepared and unprofessional was the intelligence and the army.
And, of course, most of those young women died. Last question, your biggest piece, if it isn't a genocide in Gaza.
Only two survived. Only two survived. Yeah.
Only two. If it isn't a genocide in Gaza, yeah. Then what is it? We just have 30 seconds, Gideon.
Listen, the Israelis don't seem to care that so many innocent Palestinians were killed. They just care how to label it, if it's genocide or not. And I say it doesn't matter what is the legal definition. 24,000 people, most of them innocent people, 60-70% of them women and children, 10,000 children among them. This is enough of a fact that nobody can deny, by the way, to ask ourselves, do we really have the right to do it? What does it tell about us, about our moral standards? And above all, how long will we go on and where are we aiming to? Another 25,000 killed people in Gaza will guarantee more security to Israel? And even if yes, do we have the right to do so?
Gideon Levy, Israeli journalist, author, columnist for the newspaper Haaretz, also a member of the Haaretz editorial board. We'll link to your piece. If it isn't a genocide in Gaza, then what is it?
That's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity radio show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.